Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
My mom asked me, like, do you really think school did nothing for you recently when I was talking with her about it? I said, you know what, Mom? School taught me exactly how not to go about living my life. And so for that, I am absolutely grateful. Well, because specifically, it taught me how not to learn. Again, Gatto's essay against school is like, I feel like most of what anyone needs who's new to this subject. But listening to your show largely, which gave me the ability to understand what that essay is really saying, it was not teaching me the material. It was teaching me how to be obedient, how to do work that I don't care about, because that's exactly what the corporate structure needs.
And sucking enthusiasm away from things that you could potentially be interested in.
Absolutely. Then, you know, listening to the podcast more, I realized, yeah, school was a huge issue.
Right.
And, you know, I graduated. I did go down to Mexico for this event with some people from this health community, including this doctor I mentioned earlier, because I really wanted to meet him.
Cruz?
His protocols, I mean, from my experience, they basically healed me. The advice he gave me, it was very, very valuable to me, because I was worrying, oh, how do I help everyone else? How do I convince everyone that you know, they're harming themselves? And oh my gosh, this is so terrible. And he said, you know, kid, you should be selfish. You should worry about yourself, get yourself to be as good as you can possibly be. And if you want to impact people and you're satisfied with your life, then they might be interested.
If you can show them something that they might want.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's it. Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is April 2nd. So, in the midst of my growing frustration about how adults are harnessing the energy of young people right now towards political ends that I believe are not in their best interests, politically or personally, I received an email. And I just wanted to share with you the first paragraph. Hi Brett, I am 18 and I have been watching your show for over a year. It has helped me tremendously in my process of deciding not to attend college, starting my own business, and becoming financially independent at age 18. If you happen to have some time ever, I would really love to chat with you and share my story and to hear your feedback. So Matt and I, this young man, we exchanged a few emails and I found out that he was in Philadelphia. And I said to myself, I love that place. So yesterday I got in my car and I drove to meet him. We set up a little recording studio in the attic of his boyhood home. We spent almost 8 hours together, about three recording a podcast that's going to be your whole week here at School Sucks, three installments. In the middle of our two recording sessions, we drove down to Philly and I introduced him to some of the School Sucks listeners I've had the pleasure of getting to know better there. We had lunch in Chinatown, we saw some Toynbee tiles, we went to the Liberty Bell, and Matt got to make some new friends. I will tell you this about what we recorded. A lot of people in this audience are going to learn a lot of things this week. And I think it's very cool that your teacher is just 18 years old. In this first installment, where we just get Matt's story started, an interesting thing is going to happen about halfway through. We take a sharp detour, seemingly away from Matt's story, and into the history of Eastern Europe. As this was happening, I was kind of concerned, like, ooh, this doesn't exactly follow my outline for the story about Matt. But then I realized that what was happening, without it explicitly being stated, was providing an amazing example of the kind of education that we promote on this show. And that is one that is self-directed, one that takes place out there in the real world, and one that has real, maybe even life-changing benefits for the learner. And what you're going to hear also answers a question that many of you might have. What is at least possible as far as retention and meaning are concerned when those three attributes are in place? So I let it happen. I'm much wiser for it, and I hope you have the same experience. It happens again in the installment you're going to hear on Friday on entirely different topics. This Wednesday, in the middle of the two main parts of our conversation, I'm going to release an interlude where Matt and I do some Q&A. He's in the early stages of learning about a lot of the topics that we talk about on this show, political and philosophical, but also related to things like communication and personal growth. And I love the questions that he asked. I was pretty satisfied with my answers too. So I wanted to slip that in the middle as its own separate event. Just to be clear, the schedule for this week, part one of Matt's story today, and it's a cliffhanger, part two of Matt's story on Friday, and the interlude in the middle coming on Wednesday, an interesting Q&A session. So it's Matt Maruca week here at School Sucks Project, and I hope you enjoy what I found to be a really educational conversation and a really inspiring experience. Thank you so much to Matt for coming on the show and sharing everything that he did. And thank you to all of you who really helped motivate me to make an experience like this happen and to make it shareable. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. That's the song of sunshine coming down. Welcome to School Sucks.
Thank you.
This is really great. So let's talk about what this story is so far. You're 18 years old. That's an important detail. You're the youngest guest of the year so far.
Oh.
You did not go to college?
I have not.
You run your own business?
Yes.
Right before we started the actual podcast, we've had kind of an extensive conversation about the possibility of you relocating to Puerto Rico.
Yes.
Which sounds very cool. You've done a lot of research on that. You discovered School Sucks when you were 17. In the email, you said that was partially influential in the direction that you've taken. And I'm excited about that for sure. Like, that's great news for me. I don't want to make that the focus of the whole show.
Well, it's a huge factor, definitely. Like, the School Sucks was, if nothing else, like the tipping point that made me 100% certain that the path that I was thinking about was the right path, and that the other paths that I was considering were just not the best for me.
Right. Yeah. So I read this email and I happened to be like in central Pennsylvania, and we're in your house in the northern Philadelphia suburbs now.
Narberth, PA.
So my show prep was basically to read that email, watch some of your YouTube videos, look at your personal website and your business website, and then get in my car and drive here. And now we're sitting in your attic in front of microphones, and we're doing this show. So this is very, very cool for me as well. I wanted to start, though. You said in, I think, your introductory video that you were, I don't want to call you a man looking for answers, you were a boy. You were like 13 years old when you started to ask questions about, I guess, some of the challenges that you were having, some of the things you were going through, and looking for answers that you could use to solve your own problems. So why don't we start the story there?
Yeah. So this is the house I grew up in my whole life. And as far as health goes and getting to that 13-year-old age when I was questioning stuff a lot, when I was younger, I always had some gut issues, just like gas and bloating. And it was just like a joke because, you know, I was 7 or 8 years old. It was just the funny joke. Mm-hmm. But then by the time I got older, I started, you know, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. I remember always having really bad allergies, like a spring festival we had or whatever at school, I'd be out, I'd be running back into the bathroom just like with my eyes like a zombie, real red and everything. And I was miserable. So with gut issues and allergies. And then I remember in middle school, I always had really bad headaches, just migraines, headaches all the time. And it was just not fun. I mean, you know, these are things that other people have. I assumed other people have gut issues, other people have headaches, other people have allergies. The three together were not particularly fun, though.
Yeah.
And then by the time I graduated from middle school, I went off to a preparatory high school, like a private Catholic school in Philadelphia. My dad thought I'd have a greater challenge there and whatnot academically. And so I thought it seemed cool. Try it out. Meet a new group of people. I was always kind of open-minded to that stuff. One thing that I learned afterwards is that after I signed up for it, is that they do like mandatory hair drug testing of students. So my friends and I had gotten into some substances that, you know, we're using in eighth grade that not ideal. And that's what the school was looking for. It wasn't ideal for me, at least. And so actually, I looked back at it 4 years later and realized that that period of time when I went to this school, it was only the first semester of my freshman year, so 1/8 of high school. I had to stop using substances to cover up what I was experiencing. And I think 4 years later, I realized that that's actually why I started to dig deeper, because I couldn't just hang out with my friends all day and just, you know, basically smoke pot and then kind of just do that all the time. I had to start thinking a little bit. I was kind of separated from my friends. So I thought that was pretty cool, actually, to realize that 4 years down the road. I never did until then, or more like 5 years, the beginning of this year. So I got to the school, and my issues were just getting worse health-wise. Like, I was just going on a decline. Again, I had really bad headaches every day, really bad allergies, and especially in the spring and summer, and even in the fall.
And you're like 13, 14
yeah,
years
at
old?
At this point, I was 14, first year of high school. And then the thing that was killer were my gut issues. Like, every time I would eat, I would just be painfully, like, bloated and gassy. It was just pretty miserable, and I didn't know what was causing it. And I had gone to different, for example, types of doctors, allergists, gastroenterologists, things like this for the different issues, keeping in mind that all the while I thought, well, the headaches and allergies are kind of normal. So I'll take, you know, the allergist said take Zyrtec every day or something, or a stronger horse kind of pill that they prescribed to me.
So you're getting medication, you're self-medicating, you're doing all the things that an American should do, right, to solve these kinds of problems.
That's exactly what was happening. And then, you know, for things like headaches, I was told to take Advil every day. And then from a gastroenterologist, I just remember being dumbfounded when the only suggestion they could give was for me to take Tums every day. I was like, that just doesn't sound like a solution. You know, it doesn't really sound like any way to fix something. You know, I didn't have any gut bacterial infections that they found at that time. So anyway, kept on questioning and questioning. I had tried earlier in my life too a lot of things like there was one guy who was a kinesiologist, and I don't know much about kinesiology. I still don't. It's more of like some kind of, I think, traditional practice based on certain maybe old Chinese medicine or something. And, you know, he prescribed some kind of a yeast cleanse diet. And I think when I must have been 8 or 9 or 10 when that happened. So a few years prior, I think it helped a little bit. It still didn't solve everything. I mean, I was just kind of lost by the time I was 14, right? I started to take matters into my own hands. I was like, you know, I'm not going to feel like this. I'm going to start looking up some answers on the internet. That's just, I have the internet. I could look up how to fix these issues. You know, WebMD provides diagnoses and stuff, but even those weren't very convincing for me, or they didn't seem to have any trying to understand the root issue. So
they also give you hypochondria.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Sorry, give me hypochondria.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So it was just not ideal. I should add that when I was growing up, I was very much exposed to alternative ways of thinking as far as health goes, which are often seen as you know, unscientific or pseudoscientific, but nonetheless, they are what they are. Certain things, like, for example, my mom's sister is, my aunt is a health store, like a holistic health store owner. So she sells all kinds of natural remedies, and she's very much focused on diet and healing the gut.
Preventative, too.
Preventative, exactly, that kind of thing. So that kind of had me thinking differently. My mom always tried to avoid, for example, giving us all the whole schedule of vaccines, because she, from her intuition, thought that would be less than ideal. Mm-hmm. You know, just injecting us with all these vaccines that they say they're safe and healthy. The government says they're safe and healthy, and so do the pharmaceutical companies that make them. But, you know, she was like, should we really give our kids as many as they say we should? You know, we didn't get the flu shot every year, thankfully.
So regardless of what the outcome is, it's an interesting, like, intellectual exercise to at least encounter somebody who has that viewpoint.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because it's something that most people never even think
about. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. It's just like, oh, the government says it's fine. Well, you know, just take it, you know, of course. And then, you know, my mom was getting organic food before it was really in style, you know, as early as I can remember. And so, these things all culminated when I was 14, started looking. I started with diet. I was like, well, you know, diet, that's the thing that most people go to solve health problems, to get healthier. So why not just go for that? And I did. I started researching different diets. I had been a vegetarian for maybe 7 years prior at this young phase of my life, which I think was very deleterious to my health, very damaging, because I'm, you know, growing boy. I think I definitely would have benefited from more proteins and things like that. But so I ended up starting to eat meat when I learned about this gut healing diet that I read about. Because I read, it was interesting. One day I ate a bunch of fried food from the cafeteria. I got a whole big break out of acne all over my face. And I thought, you know what, maybe it's the grease in the food that's causing me acne, because my mom had said that. And then my next logical thought was, well, then maybe my gut is damaged somehow, because the lining of my gut must be allowing all that oil to flow through, come to my skin, cause me this acne. I mean, I didn't know anything really then, but sure. I just that seemed to make sense. So I said, okay, how am I going to heal my gut? And so I researched a ton about that. And the first thing one comes across, or at least would come across in 2014 or 2013, this was, would be something like the paleo diet, the caveman style diets, which are all about trying to remove processed foods and begin to like slowly focus on eating whole foods, mostly animal or fish products and vegetables and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, basically the concept is only eat what you can find in nature and not processed food. And I felt so much better when I did that for the first week, and maybe 2 or 3 weeks I felt better. But then I started another decline. So this was really difficult for me, because I thought I found the answer. It made so much sense to me reading these different health bloggers' perspectives in this field. So I was like, wow, this is so cool.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
At this age, how are you organizing all and evaluating all of this information that you're coming across? Because even when you're – I mean, when did I start looking into this stuff? I was probably 32. Mm-hmm. So I was more than twice the age that you were when you started doing this. And, you know, I thought I had a pretty good grasp on like critical thinking and organizing information. I had been a teacher. I understood the concept of information literacy. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew how to make an outline. I knew how to make lesson plans for other people. So therefore, I should have known how to make like a lesson and action plan for myself on, you know, a new topic of study. I was feeling really frustrated navigating that world initially. Mm-hmm. So what were you doing that gave you the sense that you were moving forward towards like more knowledge or towards a better answer?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't even remember that much because it was a little while ago and I was pretty young. But honestly, I think I had like a few notebooks that I might have scribbled stuff into. And I might have just kept those just for when I was going through it. But I think almost all of it was in my head. And as far as the health stuff goes, I think the biggest impact would have been like when I knew I was feeling better.
Yeah.
That would have been kind of a marker.
Of course. Testable.
Progress. Yeah. And then honestly, otherwise, I think I might have had a note app in my phone that I was kind of utilizing to keep track of whatever it was that my current strategy was. Because literally, like, I was living in the now almost all. Well, not in the now as if like that I was in the sense I was present. It was more like I wasn't living in the now. I was desperately obsessed with just feeling better. So I was always living in the next day in a way. But on that note, it was like whatever my health plan at that moment was to try to just stop feeling like crap and stop having these horrible digestive issues and energy issues and all this stuff. That was my Bible, that whatever that little note full of the plan was for the for the coming weeks was like, that's all I'm focused on and nothing else matters. Like, I became very desperate. Things actually got much worse before they started getting better. When I was 14, that was my freshman year of high school, when I was at that private Catholic school in North Philly. That's winter, and then spring was when I was getting into the diet stuff and things started getting worse for me. By the summertime, I had taken so many different iterations of this ancestral diets of the paleo or the caveman or primal, or there's variations that go into something like what they call the autoimmune protocol for people who have autoimmune diseases, which cuts out things that trigger the immune system in the body. And I was thinking, okay, maybe this could help me. And then there was something called the GAPS diet, gut and psychology syndrome, which some woman in England devised for her child who had autism, which basically eliminated all foods that could potentially harm the gut, because the focus in that community is all about the gut. And so it was like purely bone broths and very well-cooked meats and vegetables and like a very limited scope of those things.
Sure.
And I got to the point where I was doing that because I truly was so convinced by these gurus in this community that healing my gut and dealing with food would solve all my problems.
So it was entirely a food solution.
It was like I believed it was going to be a whole food solution, and that was kind of what I'm focused on that for a reason, because I learned later on that it wasn't. So getting to that – after a whole summer of what turned into a really, really miserable eating disorder. Like, I would basically have these really strict plans that I had written out for myself. You know, get me through, and I would do this and I'd be better. Like, I always just thought, oh, 3 weeks of this and I'll be good. You know, like, it was always that mindset that just, you know, because I believed what these gurus were saying, basically these health gurus or whatever, that, you know, that just a little bit more time, or I would find that one food that was really triggering my system and causing my immune system to go whack and damaging my gut lining or whatever that was causing all these issues. So I'd find that one thing and it would click and I'd be better. That was kind of the mindset still. So even though I thought it was addressing the root issues, I come to learn later that it was not. So
can I ask you this?
Yeah.
When you put yourself in like a really restricted position like that, mm-hmm. where you're not super enthusiastic about the way that you're eating, you're not enjoying the food that you're mm-hmm. eating, were you having issues with willpower? Like, would you binge, go off the diet, eat shitty food? Would that happen?
Yeah, so that's what I was kind of getting to. I would be, I mean, in this very room here, I would be, you know, I'd bring up like, you know, 2 pints of ice cream, and I would just go through 2 pints of ice cream because, I mean, there's no way to justify it. It's like a cocaine addict. I mean, literally, after a week or 2 weeks of these restrictive diets that I'm supposed to be getting into a fat burning mode. That's what they were all talking about, is this, you get in a fat burning state. I didn't know this till much later on, but my body wasn't functional enough to be able to burn fat effectively for health, even though that's the main focus in these ancestral health communities. And so my body would basically beg me for sugar and carbs. And so, for example, something like ice cream is dense in fats and carbs. It's just like the ultimate gustatory overwhelm. So I just, right. That's exactly what my brain was just begging me for. It was like, feed me, please. Cause I was basically, I didn't know it at the time, but I thought I was trying to help myself, but I was actually kind of like starving myself of the things that the carbohydrate, which is what the body uses for energy. I mean, it could use fat, but most of our engines in our bodies and the average person doesn't function well enough to use that. I learned that much later too. So yeah, binging was an issue for me at that point along the path.
Because you were just responding to what your body was telling you to do.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I just want to pause this story for a minute. You know, one of the coolest things is that, well, I mean, just this story is kind of a snapshot or a microcosm of a bigger idea that some of us have challenges that are kind of like these blessings, right? Mm-hmm. So they could be the issues you're describing, or they could be things like addiction or some kind of other mental health problem, where we have to focus on ourselves, right? Circumstances are not giving us a choice, right? Mm-hmm. We have to go inward first, and we have to, you know, ask ourselves like questions of, am I actually getting results with this, right? Mm-hmm. So we're actually feeling like efficacious in our own lives with our own selves.
Yeah.
We can't read all the stuff that you're reading without the problems that you're having.
Yeah.
And, you know, because then we could just become like a very vocal Facebook anti-vaxxer type mm-hmm. person who just, you know, spouts off about all this stuff. And it's like, well, what are the consequences for you in your life? Or how does this affect you? Or, you know, what have you actually done to like empirically test this?
Yeah.
You know, you're at this young age, like I said, it was a challenge and a problem. And I'm sure mm-hmm. it was like terrible to go through. But you're actually getting to know yourself better.
Yeah.
Through doing this experience.
Absolutely. That's, I was.
Yeah.
I really was. And it's been, I mean, more than a blessing. I mean, I talk about it like it was tough, but I have no problems that I went through everything. I mean, I'm going to go through many more struggles in life. But now I know, like, for example, when I feel, you know, I've gotten to a lot of other things that have helped me just like try to gather my mind since this health type stuff. That have basically, you know, helped me to be more mindful. Things like the practice of mindfulness, things like yoga and meditation, I've just kind of tried to learn about because it seemed like there was something to them that could benefit me. And so now, you know, I can think from things I've learned with the practice of mindfulness, I can see myself when I'm feeling very angry or feeling very upset or feeling very stressed and see, okay, like in a way, you know, from a third person perspective, like, okay, Matt's feeling very stressed. But you know, giving myself permission to feel that, and then also seeing that all the times I felt stressed and uncomfortable, like right now, trying to restructure my getting things done in Evernote combination, and because that's like actually my external brain and how I get things done is very uncomfortable. Like I'm very, especially because I have so many things otherwise that I need to be doing, so I'm on a very tight like time pressure. Basically, I have all of today and maybe tomorrow to do that. And then otherwise I'm going to have to get back into like working, shipping orders, doing a lot of production type stuff. It's a lot of work right now. But yeah, I'm able to see that and say, okay, I must be on the brink of greatness because this uncertainty and instability I'm feeling. So as far as my back to the health story type stuff, it was pretty miserable for a while. And, I was really, really upset. Like, I can't say I was suicidal, but I think I was definitely close. Like, there was points where I was really, really down on life and really just not wanting to live. So,
and you're reaching like 16?
I was around 15. Was basically that summer when I was in that whole deal, just like a binge eating disorder and cycling and whatnot. I was 15. I turned 15 in August, on August 12th. So then that kept getting worse. And then I had my sophomore year of high school. And I got into that, and it was the same thing, just continued. I had kind of stopped with this whole binging type stuff. But my symptoms had transformed from, you know, the horrible allergies, the horrible gut issues, and then headaches. I didn't actually have any of those so much anymore. I kind of had allergies. But then when I switched all these diets, I took away the things that were, as far as I understand, that were triggering my immune system just by virtue of how much I limited my diet. So I didn't have so many allergies. And it was, you know, I was pretty confident, like, wow, I could change my health just by changing my diet. So I must be able to solve all these issues. That was my belief system. Like, I literally stopped having headaches. I stopped having really bad allergies and gut issues. Mm-hmm. So it was great. But then I started just having horrible mental issues and energy issues. Like, I was just in my head every day. I was just super tired, upset.
Oh, the fog.
The fog. It was really not good. I was really worried. And another thing is I had this because of the way I was eating this ketosis, it's basically called when you try to go into a fat-burning state.
I'm in that right now.
Oh, you are? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I cycle. Yeah. I don't stay in it.
Yeah. So I was trying to stay in it because I thought that was going to be the best thing for me. And I was getting this really like nasty taste in my mouth, which some people report as a side effect of ketosis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know why. But I was convinced my whole sophomore year, I don't know if I've ever even told anyone this besides my parents, but that I just had horrible, horrible breath. Just like I just thought that because my mouth tasted bad to me. And even I'd ask my parents, like, Mom, like, can you smell my breath? Like, does it smell bad? And she was like, no, there's nothing wrong. But I just thought this because, I mean, I was in such a fog. I was in such a mess. And so I was actually, all my sophomore year, I didn't even like hang out with my friends. This is how desperate and extreme I got. I didn't even talk to anyone to their face. It was pretty bad. Like, I really have not even, I don't think I've ever told anyone this besides like, yeah, my parents. But so that was pretty miserable for me. And so it actually, this is when it started getting better though. I mean, kind of. Well, I went, you know, I was so desperate, so sad, and I thought, you know, I needed some guidance maybe. So my dad said, like, you know, son, I don't want to see you like this anymore. I want you to get better. You know, my dad's an awesome guy and he cares about me, you know, to death. My parents are divorced. So, you know, this is where my mom, and she raised me and my siblings, and my parents got divorced when I was 3. So the same year my little brother was born, I'm 18. He's just turned 16.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad always lived like a couple miles away, and he worked. He started his own construction company and built that up, and, you know, does additions and renovations here and in Center City. Now he lives there with my stepmom of 3 years now. But so yeah, at this point, my dad was basically like, okay, son, you find any doctor and I will pay for her or him just to, you know, to help you out. And because he knew I wouldn't go to regular doctors. So I found like a paleo diet doctor, or like a primal doctor, an ancestral type doctor who had this, they would try to focus on the more alternative stuff and get some tests and try to figure out what's wrong. And so when I did get these tests, she found one thing distinct was that I had like a really kind of simplified gut bacteria or gut flora, like basically no diversity, the equivalent of what some people would refer to as like a parasite, just like highly oversimplified flora to the point where we're supposed to have thousands of species of bacteria in our gut.
Most of them are getting killed.
Lots of them. Yeah, most of them were basically, there was just like one. And I don't know how long that was the case, but so that was something that seemed to, you know, that was like a pretty big issue. And so I took all these, you know, I took some antibiotics that she prescribed to me, which I was surprised by because I thought someone in her position was like pretty anti the concept of antibiotics. But anyway, so I did that just because I felt like I had no other choice. And after that, still, I didn't really feel much better. So it was like, okay, well, I've tried literally everything now. And this was going into, I was still 15. It was January of that next year, which must have been 2016. I was miserable at my school. And this is where things start to get really awesome. Honestly, like, life started getting a lot better. I was miserable at school. I was like, I just remember talking to my mom one day at the bottom of those stairs right there, like, Mom, I just can't be here anymore. Like, I just can't. I didn't know why. I just felt like I was being constrained. I felt miserable. I just wanted to leave. It was like an escape tactic. Mm. But so then I happened one day to run into a teacher's classroom at the end of school. We had this thing called like a RAM period because our schools are a RAM. It's like some recovery academic something. And they would have just, you know, some announcements, or each teacher would have some time for students to come and talk and ask about homework or tests or do some makeup work or whatever for 30 minutes at the end of the day. And I just ran to say to this one teacher's room, and it was the end of the day, and someone had just finished giving a presentation on their experience abroad in India or something like that, or something like that. And then the teacher said, you know, by the way, guys, if you're interested, there's these government-funded exchange programs that you can sign up for. They're completely free for high schoolers age 16 to 19. And, you know, if you get accepted, you could go to any of these countries for free for a full year. And I mean, at this point, given what I was experiencing, you know, putting aside the fact that the money is obtained through force, fraud, and coercion and whatnot, I was like, wow, this is a pretty good deal.
Did you know that? Were you thinking that then?
Or? No, I was okay. not. I had right, not right, a clue. Right. I was not, you know, I had never heard of the School Sucks project and podcast. But anyway, I was like, wow, this is cool. So I applied. You know, they have the money to fly like 110 kids to D.C. to interview everyone at this like youth center.
Yeah.
And there's three, actually. There's one called the Yes Abroad program, which is the one I was on, and it was founded by Kennedy and Luger after 9/11 to try to increase relations with the Muslim world. And they send Americans to Muslim countries or countries with significant Muslim populations that are deemed safe. Mm-hmm. And then they that only started in 2008. They started bringing Islamic kids to the U.S. by like, I think, 1,000 per year from Pakistan, Afghanistan, like really, you know, places that the U.S. has really done a lot of bad things in.
Yeah.
But then they started the abroad, which is where American kids would go out, and there was like 65 per year. So that's the one I went on. But there was two. There's one to Germany that had been around for a long time called CBYX, and then there was one called NSLIY, like the National Scholarship Language Initiative for Youth, and that goes to like Russia, China. It's focused on language, India, things like that. And not to Russia. It went to a country that spoke Russian, but like one of the Baltic countries. So anyway, though, I signed up for two out of three. I actually signed up for one and got rejected, the NSLIY one, but then I was determined. And I was like, I really want to do this now. So I signed up for the other one, and I was so glad the deadline hadn't passed. Mm. So I found I was a semifinalist, which was huge because I think there might have been thousands of kids who applied, and I was like down to 110. I was like, I'm going on this because if I get an interview with someone face-to-face, I'm going to tell them why I deserve this. And so I did that. And I went to this youth center near D.C. where they flew a bunch of kids. There were kids from, like, Alaska and stuff. Got interviewed. I remember leaving that room of – you know, there was multiple interviews. They had teamwork activities they would have us do just to see, like, who was the most normal kids and who were going to be able to represent America well or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, I walked out of that room after the interview. They, like, loved me. They were definitely going to put in a good word for me because I told them my experience with health and what I had been going through. And they're like, wow, you know, like, this would be awesome for you. And I walked out of there just, like, in tears because I, like, knew I was going to go and I was going to, like, have a totally life-changing experience.
Did you vent any of your like frustrations about being in school or feeling trapped in that kind of environment, not wanting to be there anymore?
Yeah.
Did you find like a constructive way to do that? Because obviously you wouldn't want to go in there. I just think about like interviewing somebody mm-hmm. for a job.
Yeah.
Whenever I've done that, if somebody had heavy or even medium level of complaints about where they were coming from, you know, it's definitely a discouragement.
Yeah.
Just when you don't know.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, I could understand why somebody wouldn't be totally happy in any situation, work or school or whatever, but as sort of an icebreaker or a first impression. So how did you approach that
yeah.
in that situation?
To be honest,
because it was really like weighing heavily on you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Well, so it's interesting that all this while, I had no clue that school was the thing that was one of the largest factors contributing to the way I was feeling.
Sure.
And for two reasons now I know. I'm going to mention this more as I get further down my story, but one would be intellectual. The second would be the environment. And I'll explain what I mean by the environment. I don't just mean the intellectual academic environment. I mean health-wise the environment, but I'll get into that later.
Sure.
But essentially, yeah, I just went in there and I knew I had to be super positive, super honest. So I think I definitely told them that, like, you know, I want to try something new. I think I could. I mean, I always got good grades. I always got straight A's. I just don't know why, but I always prided myself on being what I considered smart. So I always jumped through the hoops and got straight A's easily. But yeah, I went in there and I just was myself, and I was honest, and I told him how I'd been feeling, and I told him I was into all this stuff about health, and I had already, keep in mind, been doing this stuff for basically a full year and a half almost at this point, this health stuff, so I was already thinking alternatively. I thought of myself as a little ahead of the curve, because this whole health diet crowd, the ancestral health stuff, they all think they've got it figured out, right?
Right.
I learned later, you know, I'll mention this in my story, but that isn't exactly the case from my view now. But anyway, I went in there, did my thing. And yeah, it worked out pretty well. I was just honest with them, you know. I didn't talk too much about school, but I definitely made it seem like I would be the best candidate to represent America well. In addition to that, I think differently. I could present a good, you know, side of the country, because that's kind of what they're looking for, you know. Because it's all about diplomacy, and it's interesting how much of an impact we had in the city we went to. Like it's actually fantastic. So I might as well get into that, because most people I talk with in the health world aren't so concerned or interested in the political aspect of things. But so I was I got a few months later, after those interviews in March, I had applied by November, interview was in March, then I got my notification in May that I was accepted, and that the country, they, because you didn't get to pick your country, you could rank your countries,
yeah,
but they just threw me. So I was sent to Bosnia and Herzegovina in Eastern Europe to live for 10 months, no coming home, just there for a year. And I was I
wasn't
lucky.
The best place when I actually, was your age.
Really? Well, it was, yeah. It was the best place when I was my age, I have to say. It was amazing. So basically what happened was, you know, yeah, I didn't get to choose. They just kind of said, okay, you're going here if you want it or not. But then there's two cities that they send kids to. There's Sarajevo, which is the Muslim capital of the city.
Right.
And then there's Banja Luka, which is the capital of the Republika Srpska, which is the Serbian entity. Do you know much about the way it was partitioned during the Yugoslav wars and everything?
No.
It's fascinating. I mean, again, on a health podcast, I would not talk about this much. But as far as this goes, you know, Yugoslavia was a country, obviously, since World War I, when Woodrow Wilson created it. And it's funny, this is so fitting for the School Sucks project. Like, I think I see this stuff so well because no one else has, literally no one else who is American has like lived in Yugoslavia. The number is like almost nothing in the former Yugoslavia, except Americans who vacation in Croatia, diplomats, and the occasional person who happened to marry someone and goes there for that reason. But almost like literally this city where I was in, I was the only American anyone had ever met. They all listened to American music and TV and shows and movies their whole life. But they never met an American. Almost everywhere I went, it was the same thing all throughout Bosnia. So it was fascinating. So long story short, you know, the history of Yugoslavia was that Woodrow Wilson created it. Because, you know, he claimed that the Serbs, Croats, Slovenes, and the Bosniak Muslims, they deserved, you know, self-determination, as he called it, after World War I. And so I think this whole problem that I'm going to get into of Yugoslavia was largely caused by America meddling where it shouldn't have been, which is very fitting for this show. I think I'm so glad that I get to share this perspective. So then, you know, there was World War II, and the Croats is what you call a Croatian person, a Croat. They allied with Hitler because they were, I don't know exactly why anyone would ally with Hitler, but I think they were afraid. And so a bit of a background was that, you know, there were the Illyrians there before the Romans. The Romans took over. It was called Illyricum. And then there was a large influx of Slavs from the north, like the Ural Mountains, the Russians. So then the Slavs took over, and I'm not sure what it was that was after the fall of the Roman Empire. It was kind of divided by east and west. I don't remember what was
this
there.
Is when the Roman Empire was east
yeah,
and west,
the Roman
right?
Empire yep. was east. It was kind of the center of the division being where it is. And then eventually the Turks took over in the early 1300s. So I guess it was, you know what it was? It was the kingdoms of Bosnia, of Croatia, of Serbia, which are where the lines came from after they created Yugoslavia. But so it was kingdoms, Bosnia, Croatia, Yugoslavia, Slovenia. They had those lines, which are almost identical to the current borders they have today. But then the Ottoman Empire took over. The Turks came over and made it all the way up to the north of Bosnia and Croatia. They took over all the way up to Austria, Serbia, and everything. So the Serbs, who I was with, basically, you know, I don't want to paint a bad picture for Serbs, but, you know, there's already been a bad enough picture painted since the Bosnian War of Serbs. But basically, they saw themselves as the guardians of Europe, in a way, from what I gathered, because the
from
Ottomans...
From the east, yeah.
Yeah, from the east, because the Ottomans were taking, you know, fighting, and the Serbs and Serbia is where the Ottomans stopped, because they couldn't get any further. You know, one might argue, well, the Germans, the people in Austria, they were stronger, so they could keep them. The Serbs couldn't. The Battle of Kosovo in 1389. The average person, the average Serb I talked with, by the way, I lived in the city in Bosnia that was in the Serbian entity, so 97% of people were Serbs. So I got a very Serbian perspective on the matter. But anyway, every single person talked to me about the Battle of Kosovo in 1389. The fact that I remember the year echoes, like how much it was told to me as if it happened yesterday. Literally,
right, right.
I forget the names, but basically these Serbian heroes basically fought the Turks, and then one surrendered and went up to the Turkish king and then whipped out a knife and cut his head off. And then but still the Turks just completely overcame the Serbs, and they couldn't, but they kind of stopped the influx of the Ottoman state into
right.
Europe. Anyway, so there was lots of resentment against the Serbs against the Ottomans. They hate them. A lot of them hate them. There's a lot of people who are more than not, the people I met just don't care about that stuff, and they're, you know, more intellectual, and they're just not interested in the old world, you know, hatreds. But it's a large thing, and it's a large theme in society still. But, you know, most people, again, just make this clear, if anyone who I met over there is listening, like, most people there are awesome. But there's still – no one would deny that there's these old hatreds that are there, and that's why the Bosnian War kind of occurred. So anyway, the Ottoman Empire fell, you know, just before World War II after, but it was part of where I was taken over – into the Austro-Hungarian Empire as the Ottoman Empire was weakening. Then World War I happened. That's what I meant to say. And then, Woodrow Wilson said these people need self-determination. So he created the Kingdom of – well, he led to the creation – or I guess he wanted this to be created. So it did. I think it's largely because of him. It was the Kingdom of Croats, Slovenes, and Serbs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a kingdom. And then World War II happened. As I was getting to, the Croats allied with the Nazis. Maybe not all Croats, obviously, but just, you know, the leaders, the people in power, decided to ally with Hitler. And they used that as an opportunity to kind of get out some of their anger against the Serbs. Because not only the Serbs and the Ottomans were fighting, but the Serbs were fighting with the Croats, and the Croats were fighting with the Ottomans. It was all, like, for the last 500 years. So the Croats used this to get out some of their hatred, I guess, against against the Serbs. And so when Hitler said, like, you should, you know, do what I'm doing, ethnic cleansing, the Croats used this authorization from Hitler
right.
to murder, you know, in this one concentration camp, which was 40 kilometers, so like 20 miles north of the city I was in, they murdered 700,000 people, the Croats did, and it was like half of them were Serbs, there were Roma, Gypsies, you know, disabled people, things like that, some Muslims. But so the Serbs, like, you know, that was in World War II. And the interesting thing is that there's, again, this is a very Serbian perspective, keep in mind, but because this is what I kind of got. But basically, the Nazis, the officials, came to this concentration camp called Jasenovac in northern Bosnia on the border of Croatia and Bosnia. And they basically said, like, what the fuck are you guys doing? This is more disgusting than anything we've ever seen.
Yeah.
It was, like, brutal. Like, I went to one of the museums that was kind of, you know, again, Serbian museum, commemorating what happened. And there was, like, thousands of pictures, like, of just dead babies, just tons
oh
of dead
God.
Babies. And they,
yeah.
like, they just, like, beat, like, mutilated children and stuff. Just, I mean, but again, that's the kind of thing that went on in World War II. But anyway, so there's lots of hatred from the Serbs against the Croats, as well as everyone in that area. So then, after World War II, whether it's a good idea or not, I mean, this is, again, keeping in mind, I think Woodrow Wilson was kind of the original cause of this Yugoslavian state. Then Tito, the general who basically helped take, you know, get rid of Nazi control of that area,
mm-hmm.
You know, he was basically like the strongest, him and his partisan army, they're called, basically got rid of the Nazis off of Europe, in addition to Russia. Besides Russia, they were the strongest push in kind of freeing Europe from the Nazis,
mm-hmm.
if you will. And so, I mean, I'm not sure if what they were doing was freeing or just changing the dictatorship.
Yeah, changing.
Basically, because, you know, it was communist Yugoslavia. And a lot of people I talked with when I was there actually talked, like the adults talked about Yugoslavia like it was a great place, because people had job security, they had money, they were powerful, their passport was the most powerful passport in the world, apparently. They could go anywhere because they were non-aligned, so they could go east, west, the Russians loved them, you know, it was great, apparently.
And they were never fully absorbed?
Never. No, they were completely non-aligned. So they were, as far as I understand, they were part of, you know, the non-aligned movement with Egypt and India.
Okay.
So they were never part of the – so actually Tito and Stalin didn't get along. And so Stalin kind of like said, you know, you got to go. Not even you got to go, but they just said they didn't want to interact. So yeah, they were never really aligned with China or Russia. It was a different kind of, it was like a capitalist communist state as it was described to me, because the people who ran the factories basically did so like capitalists. I mean, maybe it's the same everywhere in a communist state, but basically the people who Tito appointed basically made money like capitalists. There was more freedom. There was more pop culture, as far as I understand, compared to other communist states. So anyway, it was really interesting history in Yugoslavia. Like, it's fascinating. But then Tito died in the mid-80s, and this prosperous state that basically lived on his back started to kind of fall apart. I mean, I think largely related to his death, because he was in a way a visionary, but maybe it would have happened anyway, who knows. And then so Tito was born in Croatia, but he was seen as a Yugoslav. He was, you know, he did have prison camps and everything on the Croatian islands. And I always thought, like, well, it wouldn't be a bad place to be in prison, but now, of course, it's not actually. They're bare, rocky islands where people were probably tortured and killed.
Right, right.
So not a fun, actually, not something really to joke about, of course. But anyway, so Tito dies, and then someone who's distinctly Serbian, not a Yugoslav, because basically Tito would ask people, like, are you a Serb, a Croat, or a Muslim, or a Yugoslav? And basically, if you said anything but a Yugoslav, you were imprisoned, as far as I understand, or the way it was described to me. And so, yeah, he did that. He died. Slobodan Milosevic is a Serbian guy who was basically became the next dictator.
Right.
And he was hated by everyone who wasn't Serbian. So basically, I think this is another area where, again, I'm not sure, I haven't done enough research, but I think the U.S., again, led to this issue, not only from its meddling, where it probably shouldn't have necessarily in the beginning of creating Yugoslavia, but now at this point when Yugoslavia is going into chaos, the U.S. and NATO and European powers basically started encouraging states like Slovenia and Croatia to secede, giving them full authorization to do so.
So pause for a second.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was maybe your age, maybe a little bit younger, this whole story that you just told was introduced to me in, you know, social studies class, mm-hmm. or through the television, as the appearance of this madman in this region.
Slobodan Milosevic. Absolutely. That's
right?
What the U.S. government
That was
do.
The genesis
yeah.
of this story. This so and then it's like, what does the U.S. do foreign policy-wise? You know, yeah. I remember it was an election issue, I think, at one point.
Oh, yeah.
Clinton was president, but I feel like it was still happening around 96.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. Well, that was Kosovo. That wasn't the Bosnian War anymore. But so this is like, when I heard the School Sucks Project, I was like, oh my gosh, this is important. Like, this is beyond important. The material that is being shared is like very beyond important, because how many Americans, like even people who are, I'd like to see myself as young and untainted in some ways. I mean, I've been tainted plenty, but like how many people who are young and untainted and open-minded to changing their perspectives would go to a place like this and see the perspective, and it would have been different if I were in Sarajevo, which is they love America, because America basically intervened in the war. I'll get to how the war basically began, but America intervened in the war and basically saved the Muslims and the Croats from the Serbs, who are the evil Serbs. So anyway, basically what was happening was Slobodan Milosevic was elected, and then the United States and Europe basically. I think the real reason is because the U.S. – I mean, I don't really know the details, but it's because the U.S. didn't want to have a strong country that it didn't have control over. And Yugoslavia was one of the final countries in this position.
Right.
And so, you know, I think the USSR had been dissolved a bit before. I don't even know if that was 87 or
when. I mean, the writing was on the wall most of my – now, yeah. When I was a kid, it was like scary – still scary time. Mm-hmm. And yeah. A lot of like the – you know, it showed up in Hollywood. It showed up in the news. It was a big election issue in 84.
Yeah, 80s.
By 88, it had kind of – and those are just like the check-ins that I would do, because it was like when I noticed my parents paying more attention to politics, mm-hmm. that I would get some sense, or I'd ask my dad questions. My dad, very conservative. I would ask him questions about what was going on in the mm-hmm. world, or why people are talking about this. What does this mean? Because he would want mm-hmm. me to watch like the presidential debates and stuff. And I remember the first time I ever saw one, I was like 7, and then, you know, 11. Yeah, I think by 1988, the writing was – it was more than the writing on the wall. Like, they knew it was coming down.
Yeah, and Gorbachev, I don't know too many details of that, but I think he kind of led to the – he ushered it in.
He was the first public figure from – that country that's like, yeah, this is fucked, you know? And I think that was part of the reason why he had the relationship with the United States that he did.
Yeah.
But they knew, you know, absolutely. At that point.
So as far as Yugoslavia goes, you know, the U.S. doesn't, I don't think, want this powerful country. So they encourage, for example, Slovenia seceded first in 1991, I think it was, or 1990 even. Mm-hmm. And it's 1 million people, so Yugoslavia let it go. According to the Yugoslav constitution, as far as I understand, basically, the concept was that states or peoples had the ability to secede from Yugoslavia, but not states. And the reason why was because – I mean, not that they would actually ever let people secede, but because the states – this goes back to what I mentioned about the kingdoms, which is why I put emphasis on it. The states within the state – this People's Republic of Yugoslavia or whatever it was called were drawn purely based on the ancient kingdoms. So from 500 years or more prior – it was even more before 1300. So it was about 600, 700 years when those kingdoms really existed after the fall of Rome and the Byzantine Empire. They used those, the Bosnian kingdom, the kingdom of Croatia, to define those states within Yugoslavia. So just like, you know, the USA has Pennsylvania and Texas and whatnot, they had the state within Yugoslavia of Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, Slovenia, Macedonia, and Montenegro. And basically what happened was, and you know, Montenegro I don't think existed. It was part of Serbia. But I mean, no, it did exist by itself. And so then Slovenia secedes, and it was okay because it was much more distinct than for example, Croatia. Slovenia was mostly Slovenes. It was only a million people. They're much more influenced by German. Their language, their dialect of or not dialect, but their version of the language that people spoke there was much more German-sounding. And so it was like, you know, Belgrade, which was the capital, didn't really care much. And then Croatia comes along and decides to secede because of the pressure and the fact that, you know, the majority of Croatia are Croats. There's some Muslims, but not many. But then here's the issue is that because it was a non-religious state for 50 years, mm-hmm. since communism, basically, since World War II, or more like 40 years, 50 years approximately, the people moved and mixed and families mixed irrespective of their religion. But because when the United States was meddling again and trying to get the country to fall apart, people basically were forced to pick, like, you know, something that wasn't an issue became an issue. It's like, well, Slovenia's seceding, now Croatia's seceding, but okay, I was a Yugoslav for the last 50 years, but I know my family's Serbian. So, you know, okay, well, I'm married a Croatian woman. What do I do? Or I'm a Serb. I live in Croatia. Like, I don't want to secede from Yugoslavia and the Serbs and everything. We want to stay together. But the Croats, people who were Croatian, were like, well, hell yeah, we're going to, you know, we got this boundary that's already drawn that says Croatia. We might as well just take it. The U.S. is on our side. So it was pretty much inevitable they would secede. And the stuff that went on, and that was the beginning of really of the Yugoslav wars when Croatia seceded. That was the first time there was a lot of fighting in like 90, 91, 92. Mm-hmm. And it was very bloody, like hundreds of thousands of people died just in the 90s. And it was really bloody. Like there was mass exit, like ethnic cleansing, I guess they would call it, like when massive amounts of people are forced to leave their homes. I'm like, Trail of Tears, I think, would be like a very that's the term for the Americans pushing out the Native Americans, or the Europeans pushing out the Native Americans. But it was something similar. There was a term in their language that was similar for what was going on there. But anyway, so that was Croatia seceding, and that wasn't even the worst. And then basically what happened, the most mixed state right in the heart of it all, and it's shaped like a triangle. It's inland from Croatia, and so east of Croatia, west of Serbia, is Bosnia and Herzegovina. And the reason it has two names is just two regions, but it's always been called Bosnia and Herzegovina. That's like the political state. And is approximately one-third Serb, one-third Croat, and one-third Muslim, or Bosniak, they call them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the Croats and the Muslims wanted to secede because they didn't want to be part of what was now Slobodan Milosevic, Belgrade. Yugoslavia was basically becoming to be seen as a Serbian state. And so the Croats and the Serbs and the Muslims said, you know, let's secede. And so they had 2/3 of the Bosnian parliament. And so they won, of course, in seceding. But the Serbs said not a chance. And keeping in mind that the Serbs had all of the military from Yugoslavia.
Right.
So basically what Milosevic did when Bosnia decided to secede was in the eyes of the world, it wouldn't be seen that Yugoslavia was forcing Bosnia to secede. He basically gave all the soldiers and all of the military weapons a lot of them to the Bosnian Serbs under the guise of a different army. I mean, just politically, technically a different army, but still basically controlled by the Yugoslavia.
Right.
So then the Bosnian Serbs, before the vote even, because they knew it was going to happen, they actually left a lot of them, left Sarajevo, and they sieged the city for 4 full years. So as far as I understand what I read somewhere, it's the longest siege in history of its kind. I mean, there must have been longer sieges like back in Greece and stuff, but 4 years the Serbs surrounded Sarajevo, which is, I've been there. I was there 3 times, and it's surrounded by mountains on all sides, and they had tanks and everything on the mountains for 4 years, and they had to use one tunnel. The people stuck used one tunnel to get, you know, food and supplies in and out of the city, because it was just shelled. Like even now, 25 years later, there were the tall apartment buildings, like the communist brutalist structure ones, still have shells all across
right,
the side.
Right, yeah.
Like still, I mean, and tons of buildings in the city have shellings, and they had all these mortar, like in the main part of the city, they had these holes where mortars left holes and killed people, and they filled them in with like a red material just so you could see where it happened. It's really freaky. But so that's what happened. And then, so the Serbs basically and the Muslims fought for a long time in that, you know, 4 years, lots of bloody, the population was 4 million, I think, and 2 million were relocated people.
Right.
So everyone basically split. And what happened was they mined the whole country. The division between what the Serbs captured and what the Muslims and Croats had was mined. Originally and initially, the Muslims and the Croats were also fighting, but because the Serbs had so much power, they eventually had to merge together and fight together in order to have a chance to be able to succeed in mm-hmm. seceding. And so what the Serbs were trying to do, from what I gathered, was basically draw the line so that you could have a greater Serbia. That's what it's referred to as, the greater Serbia. And so like draw lines basically of where the Serbian people were living and then annex that onto the Yugoslav state.
Okay.
But basically what that involved, because people were so mixed in, was trying to move large communities that were Muslim on the eastern part of Bosnia, just bordering Serbia. And so that's where the ethnic, the genocide stuff from the Bosnian War basically originated,
right.
Because they would be moving people by large quantities, keeping them, I mean, as far as I understand, stored in like warehouses and stuff. And then when they didn't have food for their own soldiers and everything, I think, no justification, obviously, this is horrible, but instead of, you know, release the people, because they knew them, at least they claimed they were mostly men, although the world painted it as that these prisoners were mostly women and children,
mm-hmm.
the Serbs didn't want to release them because they would just be men coming back at them shooting. And so rather than have them all starve to death, I think they just killed a lot of people, just like with guns or whatever. So it's estimated or something, 7,000 people were killed. And so I know this is probably, you know, it doesn't sound good necessarily, and there's no way to make it sound good, and because it isn't. But a lot of Serbs would tell me, well, think about this, you know, 50 years ago, the Croats killed 700,000 people at Jasenovac alone. And you know, there are 7,000 people killed, and yet the world's painting the Serbs to be the bad guys. And the funny thing is that most people who have heard the show, even who are more educated than the average person, probably didn't even know that Croatia was part of the Nazi state, and much less knew that they were doing even more brutal things than the Nazis.
Right.
So, like, and Croatia is like seen as this beautiful tourist, you know, destination. And it's funny that Serbs, if they're not, and again, very Serbian perspective still, but if they're nationalistic in any way, they're seen as like the worst. You know, the Bosnian Serbs, they committed a genocide, and yet Croats continue to be super nationalistic, to the extent that in this concentration camp, on like some anniversary of something important, of the death of a general or something, they put up a sign in the camp that had on it written a term that in Croatian means, it's called za dom spremni, which means for the homeland ready, which is the equivalent of Sieg Heil in German. And they put that on a flag in the concentration camp, like a few years ago, just, you know, and I mean, and it was defended like, oh, you know, it didn't have quite of an implication of that, but it was. That was what they would say before the things they did and all that. Anyway, so it's pretty messed up, but anyway, in the end, this is where the Clinton and Americans come in, is when there was that genocide going on. It was like the U.S.'s obligation to step in,
mm-hmm.
so that America sided with the with the Croats and the Muslims in fighting the Serbs. And then, although they had basically drawn the country in half with basically mines, the Serbs and the other side, they had no choice but to surrender because Clinton basically – I've watched some documentaries of the leaders of these countries talking, you know, recounting the events, which is an interesting side note, is that the leader of each part of Bosnia, there was a guy named Franco Trudman, I think. He was the Croatian president, and he was basically heading the Croatian part of the war. Then there was the Serbian leader who was not Milosevic. It was a different guy who was head of the Serbian movement. And then there was Izetbegovic, who was the head of the Muslim side of things. And they were apparently, from what a lot of people told me, is like they hung out, they talked, they had dinners, and would like negotiate over who was going to take what town and stuff.
Right.
And that was kind of how they were doing it while their people just dying on the field. It's just interesting stuff. But so the U.S. forces forces them to surrender, the Serbs to surrender, and then flies all three of those leaders to Dayton, Ohio, and they force them to sign the Dayton agreements that create the state of Bosnia. And what the Serbs did get out of it was it created the state of what's called the Republika Srpska, which is the Serbian entity within Bosnia,
mm-hmm.
and then the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is a mix of the Croatians
right.
and the Muslims, even though the towns are still very distinct. There's Croatian towns and Muslim towns, and then there's a town in the south called Mostar. There's a river that splits it, and there's a Croatian side and a Muslim side, and the locals never go to the other side. Like, I met many people who are one or the other, and they said, I've never gone to the other side. And they never do, even though there's an international high school there called United World College, where like kids come from all over the world. I went there for a Model United Nations conference, and I met kids from all over the world. It was such an interesting concept to me. I never knew this international high school existed, but these kids would walk right across, hang out on both sides. You know, it was like whatever. People knew that school was there, but if a local who was not from the right side or the other would cross, it would be like, you know, they might get attacked. Who knows? But like such to the point where our program coordinator would be in a city that wasn't, you know, she was Serbian, would be in a city that wasn't Serbian, and she'd be like, guys, don't be yelling the word Serb, anything that sounds like that. Like, do not do
right.
that. It was really, really interesting. But so anyway, I was in Banja Luka, which is like the Republika Srpska part. And so those people would always ask me, like, what do Americans think about us? You know, because they feel like – I think a lot of people feel guilty because they feel like they were portrayed as the genocidal maniacs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so anyway, the reason I got so into that and so excited about sharing that is because it gave me a different perspective. I started thinking, like – maybe America isn't as great as it's purported to be. Here's another thing. One of the guys I talked with the first day of school, a Serbian guy, he said the year after he was born in a hospital in Belgrade, 1 year exactly after, it was blown up and lots of people were killed by the U.S. because of Serbia's actions in Kosovo, trying to prevent Kosovo from seceding.
Right.
We bombed the crap out of their capital city and killed a lot of civilians because of the issue in Kosovo. So these kinds of things were very interesting to learn about, and it painted a different picture of the U.S. government than I had thought.
Right.
You know?
So this is a big wake up for you.
Yeah.
This is a big turning point.
Yeah.
How much of what you just shared with me and my audience for the last 25 minutes did you know before you went there?
Yeah. Not a single thing. None of it.
And how long were you there?
I was there for 10 months.
Wow.
I also learned Serbian fluently, Bosnian and Croatian, but they're the same language.
We're going to pause right there.
Yeah.
Because we've got to go meet my guys downtown for lunch.
Cool.
And then we'll come back here and we'll go at least this long again.
Great.
If you want.
Fantastic.
And I'll bring this recorder in case anything exciting happens along the way.
Fantastic.
Okay. To be continued. And I'm going to leave you guys a whole 5-minute preview of where this is headed by the end of the week. Also, please check the show notes to learn more about Matt, his personal website, mattmaruka.com, his business website, raoptics.io. That's raoptics.io. We're going to talk more about his business in the next episode. And also, while you're there in the show notes, please investigate the ways you can support us, including Patreon at patreon.com/schoolsucks. Thanks. You wanted to go into that detail. And I definitely wanted to make a place for you to do that because you see it as a turning point in your life where you
Absolutely.
Started to have these interactions with people outside of the United States on issues related to the United States, politics, government, mm-hmm. foreign policy.
Oh, yeah.
That opened your eyes to, I think the way you described it is more ways to see this, or there was much more to know than what had been provided to you at that point.
Absolutely.
It made me think of a metaphor I'd used on the show couple of times when talking about history or even some kind of like political issue. And it's the metaphor of the movie scene. you can come up with an idea for a scene that you want to film in the movie. You know the actors you need to use, the lines they have to say, you know the setting where it's going to be. But then you have almost an infinite variety of choices for the story that you can still tell based on the lighting you use, the camera angles, the lenses, mm-hmm. how much you zoom in. I don't mean to torture this mm-hmm. metaphor, but like what you're zooming in on. You can even tell two diametrically opposed stories using mm-hmm. the same characters in the same script in some cases, if you're creative enough with the other choices that you make. So the same applies to the way historical stories are told. The same applies to current events and political issues. And I'm watching a lot of people your age right now in the United States. Today is what? April 1st, mm-hmm. Easter. Mm-hmm. You know, the hottest topic right now is this gun debate, the school shooting thing, Parkland. You know, those are people your age. And the thing that's really it strikes me as particularly unfortunate about it, as I've, you know, watched the way the issue's been framed to kind of motivate them. And I said to you when we were driving back from Philly, it was kind of hyperbolic, but it's like the Matrix, right? They're like harnessing the energy, rebellious energy of young people for the power of the state to basically limit people's freedoms even more. And that's kind of tragic. But in my last podcast with Thaddeus Russell, I was saying, what? I don't get this NRA thing, right? Like everything's about the NRA. They're not even like one of the biggest 400 lobbies in the country as far as the money they give the politicians. And then when this one of the kids like did this advertising boycott on a conservative talk radio host this past week to kind of like – which exposes to me something that – happens a lot on that political side, the very non-libertarian side of politics. We're really after your money, mm-hmm. right? This is really about taking from the haves and rewarding the have-nots, or punishing the haves is kind of like the theme. And then I said, oh, all right, I understand why this film scene has been set up this way, that the zoom is all the way in on the NRA. The lens is one so that every other part of this issue besides the NRA and the money they give to politicians is out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And why the light is so bright, exposing all of the flaws of this organization and the people who are a part of it. It's because this is the story that kids love. Right.
Yeah.
It's the haves and the have nots. It's one of the reasons why like left wing economics and politics are so appealing to people your age. Right. Mm-hmm. Because there are other 18-year-olds who've never earned a dollar in their life, who have a net worth of zero. If they're going to college, it's much less than that. Right. If they had to take loans.
Yeah.
And this is a winning story. This is a story that makes people like Bernie Sanders incredibly attractive. And it's also simple. But if you don't know how different treatments of events, whether they're historical or current, can be constructed and framed and even manipulated, you think you're getting the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so many people your age are so susceptible to that right now. But you're having this experience in another country that was a real education for you.
Absolutely.
Right? Where you say, okay, for whatever reason, whatever, I mean, there could have been a multitude of factors that contributed to this, but you come back from there, I'm sure it was happening while you were there too, and you say, this thing that I had seen was just a kind of selection. Like the same experience, like I knew who Slobodan Milosevic was.
Yeah.
I was just given this tiny little snip of what the whole story was.
Yeah.
You had the whole story. So this reframed your thinking mm-hmm. in many ways about not just the country, but the world. Now, I'm commending you for this, but it's actually, I use that metaphor because I'm going to put a challenging question to you soon.
Please
using that metaphor again. But I want to hear first about what happened next. That's the sound.